Your concern with ratepayer participation in rate cases, as evidenced by your sponsorship of a Cub, is encouraging. With a Cub or without the Cub, however, a fair and open hearings process prior to rate increases is imperative for Oregon. I urge you to support Senate Bill 515 and pass it on to the Senate floor with a favorable recommendation. The bill represents a return to logic and justice in rate setting by the PUC.
Thank you. Are there any questions?
Yes, sir.
Senator Day?
Have you attended some of these hearings that the commissioner has held? Have you attended some commission personally?
I attended one hearing.
Did you sign up to testify, or were you just there to observe?
I signed up to testify.
Okay. The reason why I asked that question, I was meeting with a group of Lynn County, and they were concerned about how they got a chance to testify and how they got in. Could you tell us something about what your experience was?
Okay, my experience was a very negative experience. There were several, actually quite a few people attended a rate increase hearing 9 months ago or so. I don't remember the date exactly. When we filled out the forms so that we could testify, people failed to write down their phone number, people failed to write down their zip code, and were in fact prevented from testifying at a rate case as a result of maybe not having their zip code.
Is the hearings officer prevented you from?
I'm sorry?
Was it a hearings officer that did this? Was it the commissioner or was it a hearing officer?
It was the hearings officer.
And it was the individual prevented you from testifying because you didn't put your zip code down?
Yes. Yes. Many people went down to testify at one rate hearing.
Yes, Senator Starkovich.
Did he state that on the record as a reason?
Yes. Yes. And in fact, called people down from the auditorium to come down to try to find their paper that they initially filled out to write their zip codes down.
Can you tell me where this? Pardon me, sir. Where this? What do you have? A approximate time, date, or when this occurred?
February of
82. Okay. February of 82. Mm-hmm. And where was the hearing held?
I believe it was in Salem.
Over here in the. Yep.
It was in an auditorium.
It was in an auditorium. They moved it from the PUC over to the auditorium with some of the people.
Right.
If I can ask you, it's a little hard for the witness. We have your name. I don't
right.
know who he is, and
right.
so I'd rather
okay.
you, if you have to go back again. Could you tell me what the circumstances of what the case was concerning, so I know?
It was concerning a rate hike.
It was a rate on a particular utility?
Yes.
PGE or PPL?
I believe it was PGE. If I can recall.
Okay, no, Mr. Chairman, PPNL.
I'm sorry, it was PPNL.
That's okay. I'm sorry to be so specific, but Mr. Chairman, I'd like to have Todd get me research the record of that. I'd like to see if that's what those comments that were made. I really would.
Fair enough. Any other questions?
Mr. Chairman.
Senator Roberts.
The law 757.210 for amending here does provide for automatic for rate schedule changes, which result from increases or decreases in both costs incurred by utility, or both in costs incurred by a utility. Could you tell me, in your opinion, and maybe you could cite them, in what instances rate increases have been allowed by the commissioner without a hearing, which did not involve increases in costs incurred by the utility?
I don't have that information with me this evening, but I could provide it for you.
This is very crucial to me, at least, in terms of your complaint and the basis for the bill, is the allegation that the commissioner has granted rate increases without a hearing. And one needs to know how many of those, in how many of those cases did the law specifically provide that this should be done without a hearing, or in what cases did he fail to have a hearing only because the present law says a commissioner may, either part, the may conduct a hearing. Do you follow me?
Yes.
Okay, and I think that
it seems in most cases, from what I read from, you know, in the Oregonian.
Maybe you could gather that information and get it to the committee before we have a
workshop. I could. I would
Sarah
be willing to do that.
I think that information is properly addressed to the commissioner's office. He knows when they granted increases and
I'd ask that too, but since the bill was proposed on the basis that there were hearings, there were increases granted without a hearing, I just wanted to know whether or not these were within the present, within the law, even after it was amended or not.
Okay, we'll get that information.
Mr. Chairman.
Okay. Senator Hurd?
I'd like to know on that question about the hearings, the zip codes and all of that. Mm-hmm. Did you follow that up with a call to your friendly local legislator? Or did you call the commissioner's office and complain about the way that was done?
I'm sure that there were enough people down there from all over the state that had service with PPNL. I'm sure that there was...
But you don't know if that was done?
Repercussions.
You
I don't know for sure.
You don't know if contact was made with the legislator?
I don't know. Personally, I did not contact my legislator. But I think that other folks did.
Any other questions? Okay, thank you very much.
Thank you.
And Ms. Brown, why don't I, we're going to close the hearing on 515, and why don't I, and I'll, we're going to go back to Mr. Lobdell, and you did sign up to speak on that while we have you up here.
Would it be possible for me to send a letter?
Yes, certainly would.
Okay,
you rather
I would
do that?
Prefer to do that.
Okay, yeah. Thank you very much. Okay. Mr. Lobdell? Senator Day, you said you had some additional questions.
Yes, I do.
Okay.
I'm sorry.
We're
still on 515. You're moving us. We're trying to do water resources and a few other things. Your agenda will.
Have the record show that Pat Brown is going to be sending a letter in concerning Mr. Lobdell's report.
You're going to have John address this later, Mr. Lobdell address this bill, did you say?
As good a time as any of these comments.
Thank you.
Mr. Chairman, what I want to do is go through some of the general observations that were made by witnesses opposed to Mr. Lobdell's reappointment. I just like to touch generally on those. First of all, seems that Mr. Lobdell, and you may want to, however you want to respond is fine, but let me put the first question to you. These hearings that we hold, rate hearings, and as you know, you follow the Transportation Committee almost well, it seems it's difficult for just John Q. Citizen to know how they can come and say, okay, gosh, I wish you wouldn't do this, and I don't have, you know, the expertise or all the knowledge, but here's what I'm suffering from that. How does someone get involved in a hearing like that? And you just heard testimony where and I have no way to know that that's the truth or not the truth. We'll go search the record on a hearings officer, but I I guess as you address how does the general public get involved in one of these hearings, how can we make it a little more humane? You know, in our legislative hearings, as you're well, we kind of let it all hang out and talk about it and work it over. And could you tell me, first of all, does the law prevent you from doing that now? And if it does, what would you recommend we change to make the hearings a little more open so the public feels they can come in and give you help? You may make the decision, but at least they have a chance to get at you a little bit. So why don't you try that on for size first?
All right. First of all, Senator Day, the law does not preclude a hearing prior to granting any rate increase, whether it's interim or otherwise. It does not preclude a hearing. So it's clearly within my discretion with regard to interim increases, whether the hearing proceeds or follows the granting of the increase. My experience, keeping in mind that we're involved in a quasi-judicial proceeding as opposed to a legislative proceeding, my experience has been that what the public in fact wants is an opportunity to have a public meeting, some forum in which they can express their viewpoints. I have probably orchestrated as many different scenarios of that, trying to give the public an opportunity to be heard, as you can imagine could occur over almost a four-year period. Let me take you through two different cases. And digressing, I think that the proponents of this bill will be terribly disappointed if the bill is adopted, because what they are seeking will not occur. Keep in mind that still is a hearing within that quasi-judicial concept. In the Pacific Power and Light case, we decided to try to remove some of the media aspects of that process, the utilization of that quasi-judicial procedure as a media event, and at the same time address what I think is a legitimate public concern to be heard. And we did so in the following fashion. In that case, there were two other parties represented by counsel who were presenting a public position. And prior to moving into the proceedings in the Pacific case, the hearing officer issued a ruling that I affirmed that the public participants would be joined with those two represented public participants in the case, so they had to get together to present their case. And then I went to Albany and attended a public meeting to hear the public input. And Senator Yee was present at that, and at least I think one other legislator. And you can get the story of that from Senator Yee if you choose. I thought it was an extremely good forum because it was not encumbered with the trappings of the quasi-judicial process, and I was there freely accessible to all members of the public that were at that meeting and was put in a position to respond to their questions and explain my decisions, and I did that. I had a second meeting with a group that would probably more typically be categorized as a service club. But I did have that public meeting in Albany, and it was very well attended, and it had a lot of media attention. If you recall, it was after that meeting when a reporter caught me in the hall that I let leak that I wasn't all that excited about staying around, which, you know, I had my foot in my mouth at the time. That's one scenario. In the Portland General Electric case, we went the other way, and we allowed all participants into that case. Now, it's interesting to me to note, and there in your exhibit is all the orders involving the Portland General Electric, and I just draw your attention to order 82677. And on the second page of order 82677, it denotes who the parties were that chose to participate. And there were 14 persons that filed petitions to intervene as individual parties.
Mr. Lobdell, could you, which part of this document are you referring to?
You get toward the tail end, there's a series of orders that were entered in Portland General Electric.
I have to refer to the number of the right-hand corner.
Okay, thank you.
Upper right, and dated September 23rd, 1982.
Okay.
But there were 14 persons filed petitions to intervene. Of this group, 9 did not attend pre-hearing conferences, settlement conference, or file any written communications with the hearings officer. And if you go to the top of page 3, you'll find that the previous witness before this committee was one of those parties. I find that her testimony doesn't necessarily jibe with the record in that case. The real value of the ability to grant an interim rate increase ties to the time value of money. And as you go through this record, I think you'll see that there were no instances in terms of Portland General Electric in which hearings and proceedings either preceded or followed rate increases. In all cases in general rate increase, they preceded it. In the case of the interim increases, they followed it. But the time value of the money is one of the stronger tools of the office in placing a regulated utility in a position where they are hard put not to stipulate to a settlement in a case. The appeal process, if the utility appeals, they stand in a position of losing the time value of money, and delaying the proceeding, they stand in a position of losing it. And so if you now turn to the first sheet of the exhibits that I provided you, keeping in mind that I took office in April 19th or 20th, 1979, you'll see that I presided over a general rate increase in each and every year of the term of my office. There were, in addition to the general increases, two other kinds of increases that occurred. One relating to the power cost adjustment, and the second, what we call a tracking increase. In each and every case, the tracking increase relates to rate changes that were adopted by Bonneville Power Administration. That policy is pretty consistently followed throughout the regulatory states, and makes a tremendous amount of sense when you stop to think that in the middle of the rate case, you're trying to guess what Bonneville's going to do with rates. And to eliminate the argument on both sides so that you don't end up granting too much or too little, in those cases, we defer that decision, holding the cost of power as far as the component purchased from Bonneville static until we see what Bonneville happens. And that's the reason for the tracking increase. There were allegations made that the power cost adjustment was never subject to hearings. In fact, the power cost adjustment was separated into an individual proceeding in 1979, and the order covering the results of that is also an exhibit. Secondly, that power cost adjustment was reviewed in following proceedings and further decisions made with respect to it. The second sheet in the exhibit.
Yep.
John, excuse me. Could you explain the difference between the, I guess you almost did, the difference between the tracking and the power cost adjustment? One's a BPA rate change, and what's the other?
The power cost adjustment initially grew out of circumstances that existed in 1979. When utilities were forced to go out into the marketplace and buy very high-cost power, and to run facilities, they ran Harberton for a short period of time and run very high-cost facilities such as Beaver. Now, the power cost adjustment was dropped in place to deal with that question. to avoid having to establish reserves or avoid having to grant higher power costs than you might normally grant. Trying to second-guess weather, and also to try to avoid having more than annual rate changes in terms of general rate cases. The power cost adjustment was designed to impose 20% of the costs of...
Could you define for me to avoid having more than annual rate changes when you're really changing the rates with the power cost adjustment?
I tried to qualify that quickly as general rate changes. If a utility is in a bind in terms of economic circumstances that were unforeseen, they're immediately going to come in for a general rate change. The other option to that is to allow them to purchase insurance to cover those kinds of unforeseen contingencies.
What's the difference between the two kind of rate changes? Mm-hmm. They still represent a rate change to me who's out
they
of
are,
buying.
They are clearly power, a rate change, yes.
But I guess...
Clearly a rate change,
But the difference between the two, as you said...
Power cost adjustment is a matter of running the data through a formula and seeing where it falls out, whereas a general rate case is totally adjudicated.
Thank you.
Okay. But anyway, the power cost adjustment was put in place to put pressure on the stockholders to buy power as cheap as possible. And so the stockholders had to eat 20% of the excess cost, the ratepayers 80. And conversely, when conditions went the other way, the stockholders got 80 or 20 and the ratepayers 80. Now, the second sheet shows what happened to the power cost adjustment over these last 3.5 years.
John, again, Senator Day, I think, last time brought up the question of what happens if a utility just simply goes out and makes bad investments and starts losing money on those. Are those made up in power cost adjustment?
No, all of the utilities' decisions are subject to a prudent man test. If you give me a more specific, for instance, I would... be able to nail that.
Well,
down.
I can't.
Let me try.
Okay.
If I may, Mr. Chairman, let's say that I decide I'm going to build a plant at Pebble Springs, and I'm going to make it a coal fire plant, so it's a little easier for you. And then all of a sudden, the market for I can build a nuclear plant cheaper. Decided I don't want to do it. I've done my ground cover and so forth, but it isn't adequate for a nuclear plant. Who's going to eat that cost? And I come in to you and I say, hey, I spent $40 million there for a dry hole, but I guess maybe I don't want to do it now. Forgetting that an agency intervened, who eats the rate? Who eats that?
If it's a dry hole and if my decisions stick, the utility will eat it.
And is there
if
any
the
way
plant is ultimately built, and I'll go through some of that for you.
All right, let me just stop right there if I can, John, because I want to get this clear in my mind. The plant isn't going to be built. The plant isn't going to be either because the stockholders made a decision or an agency, a regulatory agency, made a decision. It ain't going to be built. Is in any way that going to be passed through to the ratepayer under any circumstances?
Yes, judicial decision.
Thank you.
Mr. Chair.
Hey, Roberts.
But now, Pebble Springs, no. I've got Pebble sufficiently buried in a strong enough case. The utilities, in my view, have lost their right of appeal on Pebble. But
under a new
statute or a Whoops 5, possibly.
And so you're telling me that if PG, pardon me, I've got my appetite with it now. PGE goes out and they've got an investment one of those, and I don't know which one it is because it's almost like musical chairs. Skagit. And there's some question whether that's going to be built.
I don't think it will be.
Okay, and if it isn't, is the ratepayers going to pick that up through rate increases?
There's $135.1 million invested in Skagit by Portland General Electric.
Okay, and will the ratepayers?
That $135 million, if Skagit ends up a dry hole, will not be passed through rates by this commissioner while I'm in office. Now, let me give you the other side of that scenario. There's a variety of issues. The first issue is that when they embarked upon that journey and entered into a contractual relationship with Puget Power and Light, who's the prime sponsor, were they acting in a prudent manner? I'm talking what the court's going to look at, in my view. The second question that comes along is that since ballot measure number 9 was adopted, as I recall, in 68 or 78, can you have that kind of a shift in the ground rules in the middle of the stream? What, so the investment that utilities made prior to 78 may be substantially different than the investment after that.
So if I understand your answer,
the real kicker in this, and I'll come to another exhibit, but just think about this when you get to that exhibit. For Skagit, of that $135 million, $55 million is what's called allowance for funds used during construction. Keep in mind, we keep that out of the rate base. So the Federal Energy Regulatory Commission, I think we talked about that forum last time I was here, authorizes that utility to reduce their overall interest costs by the interest related to that portion of their debt as it relates to that construction work in progress, and B, an earnings item relating to the equity portion that's represented by that construction work in progress. Now, if that plant's built and it comes into the rate base, that $55 million, as it grows, will be paid for the rate by the ratepayers over the life of the plant. And there's some kind of dramatic, I think a dramatic exhibit that will show you something about utilities.
Okay, and if
I could drop back to the second sheet in the pile of exhibits, it will depict for you what has happened with the power cost adjustment. There were surcharges on customers' bills in 1979 and the first two quarters of 1980 that added up to $32 million. From the third quarter of 1980 through the second quarter of 1983, there were credits that appeared on customers' bills that added up to some $96 million. That pretty well depicts what's happening with the power cost adjustment. The next exhibit, labeled Portland General Electric and carrying the years 78 through 82, gets back to the issue of allowance for funds used during construction. There's absolutely no question that the rate growth, and my first rate decision with regard to Portland General Electric was entered early in 1980, that there has been substantial rate growth in terms of the total revenues of that company. I think you'll also notice that there has been substantial growth in operating expenses with a significant downturn in 1982 for two reasons. One reason is we've had good water and their power costs were lower. The second reason was that I ordered the company and to take a 10% reduction in controllable expenses. If you look at what their cash earnings were, you will see that there has been some growth with a low period in 1980 of only $4.3 million. Now, why does that company appear so profitable? Well, under both FERC's rules and the ground rules governing their annual financial reports, they are allowed to increase the bottom line, the net earnings, by the amount of allowance for funds used during construction. But those are not real dollars. So they're bookkeeping entries, and they go out and borrow the money to make that coverage, which changes the debt structure again. If you look at Portland General Electric Systems earnings, tied to both their cash earnings plus their allowance for funds used during construction, they went from a low of 5.87 on equity in 79 to a high of 14.6 in 81. If you look at what their return was in terms of their cash earnings, it went from a loss low to a high of 5.46%. The next to last line indicates what the authorized return on equity was for those various years. And that figure is tied to what, keeping in mind there were general rate case changes in the middle of the year, and so you average out the authorized rate of return for so many months and then for the remainder of the year. During that period, there was...
John, excuse me. The cash earnings on equity 1979, that should be a loss of $27,000. Is that right?
I hope so, or my math.
Well, it doesn't show that. That's why he's asking.
Yeah, it should have been bracketed. But during the year 78 to 82, they have invested some additional near $800 million, most of that going into construction work in progress and plant of one kind or another.